Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Friday, February 13th. That's Friday the 13th, 2026. Present today are Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, and the co-chairs, Co-Chair Schrage, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Representative Bynum may be joining us telephonically. He previously was excused from this legislative business here in Juneau and will not be in attendance today. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start today, please mute your cell phones. At this meeting, the committee will be introducing and adopting, we believe, a committee substitute for House Bill 289, the governor's supplemental bill. Then we will have our first hearing on House Bill 280, apportionment of taxable income, highly digitized businesses. Of course, that bill relates to what we heard yesterday as well. First up is House Bill 289. In committee's members' packets are the following documents. House Bill 289, work draft version G, isn't good. House Bill 289, redline comparison between governor's version and version G. House Bill 289, agency summary totals all funds. House Bill 89, agency summary totals unrestricted general funds only. House Bill 289, transaction detail. House Bill 289, transaction comparison between governor's version and version G. And finally, House Bill 289, capital project detail by agency. The Legislative Finance Division is in the room, and Legislative Legal is online for any technical questions during this meeting. Also available in the room for questions is Lacey Sanders, a director for the Office of Management and Budget. So the first order of business is to introduce this bill. Do I have a motion on the committee substitute for House Bill 289, version G?
Very quick, at ease.
Yes. At ease.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 289, Finance Work Draft 34-GH2638-G, marks, dated February 12, 2026, is our working document.
Okay. I'll object for the purposes of an explanation, and I'll call my staff forward to explain the changes in version G. Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt. Is there a summary list of the changes, like in a line by line, like was provided prior to the CS executive summary of each item that's being changed in this? If there is, I just don't see it in my packet. That's why I asked the question.
There is no such document. I think that when we hear from Mr. Alper and you hear what the changes are in combination with the OMB director's presentation on either February 2nd or 3rd, it should make sense. Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, Ken Alper, staff to Representative Josephson. I am working from my own notes with your okay, I could share them with Representative Stapp later, but they're a little messy and not really clean for general distribution. Mr. Chairman, what you have before you today is a bill that merges the supplemental items from several different bills. HB 263 is the governor's operating budget, HB 264, the governor's capital budget, which were submitted on December 11th. Those items were brought together. You will recall in the committee's bill, House Bill 283 that I introed from this chair on January 27th. And then there's the underlying bill, House Bill 289, the governor's supplemental bill that was introduced by Director Sanders on February 4th. So the bill here combines both of those. In addition, this is the first committee substitute to a governor appropriation bill, which means you're getting the work of the technical and stylistic conversions between the administration's drafting style and legislative legals. So there's a lot of small technical changes that you'll notice, particularly in the red line version. What I hope to do, Mr. Chairman, is walk through the red line where you could really see the differences in what has been added and taken away from this bill versus what was produced by the governor's office. So if members would refer to that, to the red version that looks approximately like this as I go through the bill. You'll notice in here there's a lot of red. That generally means something has been brought in from the governor's operating or capital bill, from the other's bills. I will call out any divergence from a clean bringing in of something else. I also want to point out two things that are not in this bill that were in the governor's original supplemental request, so therefore you won't see them here at all. They're relatively minor. We've removed the standard annual sweep language that puts the tax revenues that fund the SPAR oil spill prevention and response accounts and moves those funds into those accounts. Those will, it is my understanding, it's your intention to add them to the operating budget bill itself. Likewise, there's a single capital item in DCCED, a $650,000 reappropriation to match some U.S. Department of Energy state energy program funding from the feds. That will, it's my understanding, be added in the future to the capital budget. So they are not in the bill before us. So walking through the red line version now, the first thing I'd want to point out as a good example, too, on page 1, in the title of the bill itself, you see red line language adding a reference to the constitutional budget reserve. It's red because it was not in the original governor's supplemental bill 289. Instead, the governor had a supplemental CBR draw section in the operating budget in 263, and it's being moved from there to here. Numbers section, the operating numbers sections of the bill, sections 1 through 3, are on pages 2 through 14. And, you know, I invite members to page through quickly, but you can see the numbers aren't changing, the formatting's changing a little bit, but all of this is the same. A few of the words might be different, a few of the items have been resequenced, but the numbers and the agencies are all exactly the same in sections 1 through 3. Clear through page 14 of the red line document.
Okay, let's give the members just a moment on that. And Mr. Alpert, by introducing a payment method or a fund source, when the OMB director appeared before us on the 4th, I'm sure I asked how would these be paid for, and I think she noted that it would have to be the CBR, that there was no other fund source. I know I asked her about that.
Mr. Chairman, an appropriation bill is an authorization to spend. We're supposed to have the money before we can do that. And, yeah, because the FY26 budget is in deficit, we're going to need to identify a funding source, and that will be at the end of the bill, the constitutional budget reserve draw.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. I appreciate him going through everything, and I'm just going to ask you, would you kind of reconsider about giving us more of an itemized sheet when you have time? As we discussed earlier with Representative Stapp.
We can. I'm just reminding the members of the voluminous, large spreadsheets given to us by OMB. So it's going to be a repeat of each of those items, would it not?
Well, I mean, that's a voluminous, large spreadsheet.
Mr. Chairman, my notes are 3 messy pages. If members want them, after the hearing, it probably can clean them up in a few minutes and get it into a distributable format.
Thank you.
But hopefully we can get through the description of the bill in advance of that.
Okay.
Right. It could be tomorrow. It's fine.
Yes. Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I think there are 2 different types of information that we could get. We could either get the transactions, every single report, item, and there are many, 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 many of those. And then I think there's also the kind of the high points, which I think is what Mr. Alper is getting to. And I think that's what Representative Allard is maybe looking for, is the kind of the main items. And so anyway, and I think the 3 pages, from my understanding, could probably be summed up in really 1 page. So.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we'll look at my notes together after the hearing and figure out what I should get together for members.
But I do think we should be clear, should we not, Mr. Alper, that if it's the abbreviated version, it's not going to repeat every item in this bill.
No, it might have a sentence about every section, but by no means is it getting into every item. And because so much of this bill is unchanged from the previous bill, it doesn't really need to get called out in the details.
Right. And I'm being reminded that all the items in the transaction detail in your file and the capital project summaries are in the members' packets, but not as in the form of an executive summary. But the answer is yes, we can get you that executive summary. You bet. All right, so we've identified that in the first three sections, it's sort of, as I call it, same-same with some language stylistic changes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So then we get to sections 4 through 6, which is the so-called numbers section for the capital items in the supplemental budget. And that is mostly same-same, meaning some things are worded a little differently, resequenced, realphabetized. The big change in there, and I will direct members to the middle of page 16 of the red line version, that is new red language. That is that is from the governor's capital budget, and that's the $70 million DOT item, the match money for the federal highway funds that we've all heard about with our public testimony and so forth. This is an addition simply because it was not in the original version of 289. It came from another bill. But the dollar amounts are exactly the same as what was in the governor's proposal.
Okay.
And other than that, the rest of the capital numbers section remains the same.
Okay. Please continue.
Yes. Yeah, so that brings us then to page 24, which is where the language sections of the bill begin.
Right. So if members turn to 24. Go ahead, Mr. Alper.
So on page 24, sections 7 and 8, they're just technical changes, some wording, but nothing is different from what was in the governor's original 289. Section 9 is making certain technical changes, and then towards the bottom of it, we're now in the middle of page 25, there were some number corrections in subsections D and E that are relatively minor, but were corrections that were caught by legislative legal.
All right, so a cleanup of minor changes in D and E.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
On page 25. All right, yes. Please continue.
Section 10 is it removes a $1 million statehood defense appropriation to the Department of Law. This was a policy call by yourself, the chairman, and it is, to my knowledge, the only discretionary deletion that's in the bill.
Okay.
I just wanted to point that out for yourself and members. That's where it appears. Section 11, now we're on the bottom of 25, and at the 13, just technical language cleanups, nothing changing. Section 12 is red line language because it comes from HB 263, the governor's operating budget. What this section is doing is amending the current year's Alaska Marine Highway budget from last year's House Bill 53, the operating budget, to extend that appropriation for 6 months. So it ends instead of on December 31st to next June 30th, 2027, making it a multi-year. This conforms with the governor's changes in his proposed marine highway budget and in the operating budget that's also before this committee, changing it from a calendar year to a multi-year fiscal year appropriation. So this aligns and conforms with the expected changes to the future marine highway budgets.
Okay.
Now we're on Section 13. That's a technical change, no material meaning. Section 14 is identical with no change at all. Now we're on Section 15, which is fund capitalizations, and for the budget nerds, also often the most important and interesting part of the budget, the most exciting part. So subsection A has no changes straight from the governor's budget. This is changing the fund sources from some money that's going to the fire suppression fund other than general funds. Subsection B, the $40 million to the disaster fund, that was in the governor's operating budget. That's a number that we've been talking about all session. Subsection C is new, and members should understand this one. This is an additional $35 million on top of the first $40 million also to the disaster fund, which would equal a total of $75 million. However, subsection C has contingency language attached to it on the back of the bill in section 24. And if members want to page to the last page and look at that contingency language, I'll speak about it for a moment. And what that language in Section 24 says in plain English, we are currently in a dispute with the federal government. The Federal Emergency Management Administration was supposed to pay 90% of the costs towards the Typhoon Halong recovery efforts. Right now, they're only paying 75%. If we are able to get that changed, then we won't need this $35 million. But if we are in a position where the state is going to be paying 25% of the Halong costs, this additional $35 million would take effect if this is not resolved by June 30th.
Okay.
Okay. And if members are clear with that, then I'll page back to page 27 in section 15 where I left off. So that was sub C. Sub D is the fire fund, $55 million. This number was talked about when I presented the committee's supplemental bill on January 27th. That number is in OMB's reports and in their tables. It has not yet appeared in one of their budget documents. It's the best currently available number. There is a chance it will change, Mr. Chairman, and if it does, as this bill moves through the process, if and when OMB provides us with an updated number for the fire fund appropriation, you may want to consider an amendment to the bill at that point in time. But for now, it's the best available number.
Okay.
We're now in Section 16, which is called Fund Transfers. This is the paying back of the Higher Education Investment Fund, which was what the administration used in last year's supplemental, what the legislature appropriated to pay for the budget shortfall in the FY25 supplemental last year. The way the governor brought this to the committee originally was as a direct appropriation from the CBR to the Higher Education Fund. We transitioned this and made it into a fund transfer instead, so it moving general funds to the Higher Education Fund, which is then a single larger CBR draw. Instead of having a two-part CBR draw, it's a single CBR draw, the way we've structured it. But the dollar amount is the same.
Okay. And the result would be the same.
And the result is the same, exactly, okay. Mr. Chairman.
All right, now new Section 17.
It's amended Section 17, but it's a little bit complicated, Mr. Chairman. What's happening here is it's a technical rewrite to Part B, which is a small federal disaster rewrite, a small federal disaster grant. And then Part A is really being deleted, but they're reusing some of the words in rewording subsection B. And the reason Part A is being deleted is it was an attempt to reappropriate an appropriation last year as a grant to help with the organization of the new borough that's being set up in the southeast community of Hoonah. But that appropriation last year had a contingency language on it that it only takes effect if the borough is organized by the end of the last calendar year. That has not happened. For whatever reason, there is no Hoonah borough yet, and therefore that appropriation from last year is functionally dead. It can't be reappropriated. So on the guidance of legislative legal, we've removed it from the bill.
Okay.
Okay. So that brings us now to sections 18 and 19 on page 28 of the red line. They are just technical rewrites. Section 20 is a long section. It has a lot of technical rewrite, but what's going on here are a list of reappropriations within the Department of Transportation of small amounts of leftover money from a large number of old transportation projects from budgets, some of them going back 20 years. And in sum total, they add up to about $5 million, and that will go to the Department of DOT for emergency response, catastrophic events, and so on. So the list is more or less the same, and I want to call out for the committee a couple of things that changed. You'll notice first with the red lines in sub 2 and sub 3 on the bottom of 28, those look like they're being deleted, but they are not. They are simply being resequenced per the preferences of legislative legal. Number 2 is now number 19. You'll see a couple of pages later on in the bill. And number 3 is now number 23, also a couple of pages later on in the bill. So they're still there at the same amount and the same originating project. And then you will see, likewise, number 14, and that I'm moving to page 30, is being deleted and replaced by number 24. In this one, there's a minor change. The dollar amount is the same, but the project we're taking it from is different because we learned that the original project referenced in number 14 there, which is 88th Avenue in South Anchorage, appropriated in 2012, well, that had previously been reappropriated to another purpose, where there's still leftover money in the second use. So number 24 is going to the second use and reappropriating it from that to the intention of this section, which is this critical response money. Number 15 is actually being removed from the bill. And the reason for that happening is, likewise, number 15 has previously been reappropriated as well. It was reappropriated to the Capital Income Fund, I believe, in 2023, and has been spent, so it's no longer available for reappropriation. And that one, Mr. Chairman, you'll see number 15 is $99,000. Because that one's actually coming off the list, if you go back to the beginning of section 20 on page 28, there's the sum total line, page 28, line 19, is being amended, and that number is about $99,000 smaller than it was in the original bill, reflecting the elimination of subsection 15. And I think I'm going to pause right now and just make sure everyone's caught up with me.
Mr. Alpert, to be clear, in this section, here I'm talking about section 20, these are governor's items.
Mr. Chairman, as presented to us, they are governor's items. As moved around and cleaned up, it's our items, but really it's legislative legal telling us what technically needed to be done. There's no policy calls within your office or anywhere else in the committee that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right.
Okay. We are now on the middle of page 31 in the section that's the Constitutional Budget Reserve Draw. Now, subsection A of that describes what the draw is paying for. It's that whole subsection A is one sentence long, so it's tortured syntax. But in plain English, what it says is, if approved, we will pay for the UGF, unrestricted general fund appropriations in this bill, plus any shortfall from the three budget bills that passed in the previous session, operating capital and mental health. The line items in this CS, everything that I've previously described this afternoon, is about $408 million. Based on the fall forecast, the existing budget that we have is in deficit by about $51 million. That number, the $51 million, will shift. It will shift based on a couple of variables, mainly what's the price of oil between now and June 30th, which impacts the state's revenue and can make that number smaller or larger. There's also the determination in the dispute with the federal government over the so-called disparity test for education funding. That might affect the FY26 deficit as well. But presuming that the forecast comes in as anticipated, $51 million, the sum total of the CBR draw to fund existing spending and new spending in this bill is $460 million. Then at the very end of the sentence, line 28 of page 31, you'll see the words plus an additional $30 million. That is what's referred to as headroom in budget parlance, meaning it's leaving space for additional supplemental items that could later be added to another budget bill this year with fiscal year 2026 effective dates. And that section added to the others would bring the total CBR draw up to about $490 million.
Okay.
And then subsection B of section 21 is the reference to the section of the Constitution, Article 9, Section 17C, which is the part that says that the draw in subsection A will require a three-quarter vote of both bodies to be enacted. We're now on the last page of the bill, Mr. Chairman, page 32. Subsection 22 is technical cleanup related to the description of capital projects and how they're funded. The new language is being added because there's new capital sections in this bill, but the content of it, the purpose of it, remains the same. Section 23 is a cleanup to the retroactivity language. Most of the bill will be retroactive to March 1st, 2026, with the assumption that it's not enacted until some point after that. Section 24, I spoke to before, that is the contingency that is tied to the additional $35 million going to the disaster fund, having to do with the Federal Emergency Management Administration's determination as to what portion of the disaster cost they're going to pay for versus the state. And you could read the language. It's relatively clean. Sections 25 and 26 are the effective dates, all of them in fiscal year 26, some of them with the June 30th for the reapprobes. The ones that are more substantive go back to, I believe, March 1st. They have an immediate effective date, which is whenever the bill is enacted. And that's it, Mr. Chairman. This is the supplemental budget. I'm happy to take any questions.
And Mr. Alper, a legislator, including myself, in year 14 of my time here, could be forgiven for thinking this document looks complicated, but the net result is it's a combination of supplemental asks from the governor from two sources, plus an allowance for more disaster relief in the event our appeal to FEMA fails, plus the removal of one item of $1 million in the Department of Law supplemental request, and the headroom issue. In other words, it's all governor's items except four items, something like that?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, there's also the two minor items that were removed with the intention of adding them to the operating and capital budgets that I mentioned at the beginning. So maybe there are six, but you've nailed it, Mr. Chairman. This is the governor's supplemental, by and large.
Questions about the draft G? Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Justin, through the chair to Mr. Alper. Is that additional $30 million? I just want to clear on the record the additional $30 million headspace for the CBR draw. That is a policy call, though, and that's not in the governor's supplement, through the record.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, yes. The protocols that we go through, this is supposed to be a fast-track supplemental, meaning we want it to pass relatively early, and that requires working closely with the other body. I'll be frank, Mr. Chairman, Representative Stapp, this came from the other body. This was their preference to add that headroom in there, believing that there might be unforeseen issues that arise later on in session that they would like the ability to cover. It was a policy call, but it wasn't really ours.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions about version G? Okay. I don't see any. So at this point, I want to thank Mr. Alper. I don't see any further objections. I'm going to remove my own objection. Are there further objections?
I object. Okay.
So there's an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. So it seems like this went from $300 million to $500 million to $550 million for this supplemental, give or take a few million. I only received this morning. And then we had floor and other things going on, so I didn't have a lot of time to review it. I understand what you're saying, Chair, is that it doesn't seem complicated, but there's a lot of dollars that have been added. And I do want to get to work on it, move as quickly as possible, and I'm looking forward to the just getting to work and finishing it. So thank you, and I remove my objection.
Okay. Well, I will object for the sake of speaking if I may.
Objection is heard. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Appreciate it. And my thoughts on this are kind of the same. I mean, we just received this morning, and there's a lot of messy notes to, discombobulate. And so I kind of look at some of these appropriations as maybe a debit card for FY27. And so I don't think that's quite appropriate. I think we need some discussion on that. But at this time, I'm going to remove my objection so we have the chance to discuss it further and maybe make amendments and that sort of thing. So I remove my objection.
Mr. Albert, a comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just, particularly in response to Representative Allard and the big numbers, just to spin the sum total of this out there, the governor's proposed supplemental budget from December was about $345 million. The governor's new supplemental items that came in on February 3rd was about $80 million. That brings us to $425. there are really two new things in the budget before you, the $35 million in additional disaster and the $30 million headroom. So that's 65 plus 425 is how we derive the 490 number that I referenced earlier in my comments.
And your reference to the disparity test is already baked in by the work we did last year. That is, it doesn't to fully fund the foundation formula, we simply wait. We hope that we win the appeal, and we're basically spectators.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I'll go as far as this as I feel competent in if this follow-up questions you might want, Mr. Painter. But the I mentioned earlier on the underlying deficit is $51 million based on the fall forecast. If we fail the disparity test, that means there will be a reduction in federal education funding and a need to be backfilled with state education funding. Now, that money is appropriated. It's covered in the language in last year's operating budget that funds the K-12 formula that says the amount necessary, estimated to be. The amount necessary simply increases, and we have a memo from Legislative Legal that confirms that. So if we fail the disparity test, and the disparity test is, let's call it $70 million, plus or minus, that would really increase the size of the deficit before the passage of this bill by about $70 million, and therefore it would increase the size of the draw by another $70 million.
Representative Hannon, did you have a question?
I did, and I guess, thank you, Chair Joseph, and I just want to clarify, in case I misheard Representative Tomaszewski's, or it's misinterpreted, because he said it creates an FY27 debit. The entirety of this bill is expenditures in fiscal year 26 in supplementals, with the exception of the multi-year AMHS request from the governor to give them another 6 months multi-year appropriation. Everything else is current fiscal year supplemental. It is not FY27 monies. Am I correct?
I think you're completely correct.
Mr. Chairman, just to take a step beyond that, to Representative Hannon, it's all FY26. These multi-year structures, although they allow the money to be spent in the subsequent year, for accounting purposes, it will all be on the books as an FY26 appropriation.
Representative Stapp.
Chair, I think there was a motion to adopt. There was an objection. The objection was removed, and now we're talking. So I don't know exactly where we're at.
Didn't you object?
I did not object. It was just Rep. Allard and Tomaszewski. But just for the record, I'll remove my objection, too, so we can...
Right. So I'm going to ask... one might say that this is good chairing of a meeting to allow some dialogue with a standing objection. But I don't mean to suggest I'm good at my job. You decide. Representative Tomaszewski, you have an objection. Do you maintain it?
Well, actually, I removed it before, but I would like to ask another question. So okay. Do I need to object before?
I think, go ahead, object.
Object. Okay, so I object for the sake of discussion. Yep. I see we have Ms. Sanders in the audience here, and the co-chair did reference something about funding, and I didn't know if Ms. Sanders wanted to maybe shed some light on the information. If she would.
Sure.
Maybe.
Director Sanders.
Yeah.
And I think for the record, what Representative Tomaszewski is talking about is no one knows better than Director Sanders, we don't have current general fund to pay these bills. And so we dialogued about the source of paying these bills, and I think we agreed it was the CBR. Ms. Sanders.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, are you asking me specifically about where the source of money would come from in the governor's proposed budget? Is that what the question was?
Through the chair, I was actually just responding to the information that the chair spoke about, mm-hmm. and referenced you specifically in the funding source. So whatever that was for whichever department, if you had any information on that.
Okay.
Director Sanders.
And I apologize. Lacey Sanders, Director of Office of Management and Budget, apologize for not putting myself on the record earlier. Chair Josephson and through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, when the governor's proposed budget was introduced, it included supplemental requests, and it also included language in the operating budget that would draw from the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, if there was a shortfall. As noted earlier by Mr. Alper, there is a shortfall in revenue in the current fiscal year just due to the nature of oil prices. That is projected to be about 50, our numbers are close to $52 million. The remainder of the items that were presented in the governor's bill would be required to be drawn from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund or another source if the legislature chose another source. This version of the bill identifies that source as the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Is your objection maintained?
My objection is removed.
Any other objection? Representative Valor, do you object?
I object. I was hoping he wasn't going to remove it so we didn't have to go through that again.
All right. Representative Valor, do you have the floor?
Thank you, Chair. So I appreciate the feedback that was given in regards to my comments, but the fact of the matter is the governor's not in charge of the budget. We are. So whatever the explanations are of why the budget is the way it is and the disaster and the ceiling of another $30 million just in case, doesn't matter. I think the public still needs to know what the numbers are and why they're there. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. That's all.
Do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Any other objection? Hearing none, version G will become the working draft. If there are no further questions, we will set an amendment deadline for version G on House Bill 289 for Monday, February 16th at 10:30. To file amendments, please use the amendment template on the Legislative Finance Division website. Please also remember the following. If it is a numbers amendment, LFD can assist with drafting and reviewing for technical adjustments. If it is a language amendment, you will need to coordinate with Legislative Legal to draft and review your amendment. All amendments should be submitted electronically to my staff member, Alexander Schroeder. We'll now take a brief at ease to turn the gavel over to Chair Foster and prepare for our next presentation. Yes.
Thank you. I want to just clarify in the record because you said 10:30, and I assume that's 10:30 a.m.
It is 10:30 a.m.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go at ease at 2:12.
We're asking about that.
We'll talk about it.
Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:12 p.m., and we do have one bill before the committee this afternoon. That's House Bill 280. That is the digital tax bill. We'll introduce the bill with a presentation. We'll take questions, and then we'll set the bill aside. And so with that, I'd like to call up my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson, if you can put yourself on the record. And just so folks know, we do have online Mr. Mike Williams, Corporate Tax Manager with Department of Revenue. And Mr. Anderson, how many slides long is this one? Is this a shorter? Do we need, or can we take questions during the, it looks like it's pretty short. Would you like questions during your presentation or after?
Through the chair, that would be fine to take questions along the way.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so if you could put yourself on the record and just give us maybe the big picture, put some context on why this bill looks very similar. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Today I come before the committee to introduce House Bill 280. The Appropriation Taxable Income Digital Business, known as the Digital Compact Bill. I will move through the slides relatively short for fast. This bill has come before the committee in two forms-ish prior to this hearing. One of them was the bill that was vetoed last year, which was Senate Bill 113. This is an exact identical to that bill that was vetoed. And then also you've seen portions of this yesterday with the rollout of the governor's bill in one certain portion that I will identify. On slide number two, you'll see that this is more of a history. We did get a history of the comprehensive multi-state compact from yesterday from Department of Revenue. I'll just talk about a couple more components of that. The multi-state tax compact is used to determine the state's corporate income tax for C corporations operating in multiple states. It determines what portion of a state's income can be taxed by each state. The 6th legislature codified the multi-state compact in 1970, and since then there have been zero changes made to that since codification. Things factoring also under the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution also impacts the way we identify how to tax in our state. The Commerce Clause says that we can only tax those things that are considered reasonably attributed to the activity in the state. So Alaska determined at one point that we would use an apportionment formula based off of three factors: percentage of sales, percentage of property owned in Alaska, and then percentage of payroll. Next slide is slide three. This is just a visual representation of what that formula looks like. You have the share of total corporate income appropriated is equal to AK property divided by total property owned, Alaska sales divided by total sales, and Alaska payroll divided by total payroll divided by three times that total income, which gives you your taxable portion. Why are Alaska's apportionment laws antiquated? Turn too far. The apportionment formula was written when businesses were mostly brick and mortar and almost all business was conducted within the state and sales. With the internet and digital economy, corporations now operate in multiple states and completely online. C corporations now make sales throughout all of Alaska without ever having property, storefronts, warehouses, or provide any payroll in Alaska. So Alaska's old way of this three-factor apportionment is antiquated and outdated. Next slide. House Bill 280 makes two reforms to bring Alaska's apportionment system into the 21st century. The way it does this is there are two parts to HB 280. The first one is to amend the multi-state compact by adopting a market-based sourcing. This will ensure that Alaskan sales are properly apportioned to the state. And then the second is to create an apportionment method for highly digitized businesses and uses a single factor apportionment method of sales. Most importantly, HB 280 does not change corporate income tax rates or the brackets. And this portion of the multi-state compact changes going to a market-based sourcing is the one component that is in the governor's bill that is identical in every nature. The second point of apportionment for highly digitized businesses, that is where this bill will deviate from what has been presented so far in front of the committee this year.
We do have a question. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you. And so we have some frequent watchers on gavel to gavel here, and some of them might be thinking, what is your definition of a highly digitalized business? And for those watching folks out there, maybe you could answer that.
Through the chair, I could answer that question now, or we go into that more clearly on later slides. But I can jump to the punchline if the committee prefers right now.
Go ahead.
All right. If the members go to slide 8 of their slide deck, you will notice, when is a business considered a highly digitized? A business would be considered highly digitized if 50% or more of its Alaskan sales are from these components. Tangible properties purchased through the internet, intangible property delivered electronically, or services delivered electronically, and the services are related to computers, electronic, transmission, and or the internet technology. So those type of items are almost exclusively done via the internet, and which requires them not to have any sort of presence outside of the use of a computer in the state. So the sale of those things would be highly digitized.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed back to slide six.
Moving to slide six. So HB 280 replaces what they is known as the cost of performance with this market-based methodology, and this is also the same in the governor's tax bill as well. Alaska currently uses the methodology, what is called cost of performance, to determine whether or not this sale happens in Alaska or not. Under the cost of performance, a sale is considered to happen in Alaska when the income-producing activities is performed in the state. So what this creates is this out-of-state corporations would argue and do argue that online sales happen not in the state, but either at their corporate headquarters or the server farms or wherever that transaction of purchase takes place. If we move to a market-based sourcing, a sale occurs in Alaska when, for real property, that property is located in the state. For tangible personal property, that property is located in the state. For services, when that service is delivered to the state. And then also for intangible property, when it is used in the state. Currently, there are 36 other states that use this form of market-based sourcing, and that was a point of discussion yesterday in the committee as well. Moving on to what is a highly digitized business. This is a formula that would look like when we go to a single apportionment factor. Once again, very similar to the old formula that I shown earlier, this shows that the share of the total corporate income apportionment is equal only to Alaska sales versus their total sales times that income. In this bill, HB 280, the traditional three-factor formula will still apply to all brick-and-mortar businesses or any business outside of the current exemptions that exist in statute. So brick-and-mortar businesses outside of something defined as highly digitized would still have that three-factor apportionment. I've covered this slide already. What is a business? How do we consider what is a highly digitized? Moving on to the next slide.
Question before we move to the next slide, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Mr. Anderson. I don't know if you can answer this question. Probably not. I'm going to ask it to you anyways, so a non-answer is fine. But mechanically, if I am using a single sales factor at a 50% threshold definition of highly digitized, and I am a company and I do have some property and payroll here, there's like a delta in which I could probably change my business structure and how I do my gross receipts to kind of not be considered that. And there's a kind of a financial advantage to doing that because your three-factor would effectively make you pay a less amount of money. And I'm curious if there's been any thought in studying that mechanic and modeling it with revenue or someone else through the chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, thank you for the option to say that is a great question, Representative, and I will have to get back to you. I do know that modeling and conversations with Department of Revenue for that single factor has been considered. We just don't have anything at this time.
And I know that we do have Mike Williams. I don't know if Mr. Williams might be able to just give some kind of a brief answer without having a full analysis of that, but I do want to give him the opportunity. Mr. Williams, if you're online, if you can just state your name and your position.
Thank you, Chair Foster. This again, Michael Williams, Corporate Tax Manager for the Alaska Department of Revenue. Through the Chair to Representative Staff, our economic research group has done some modeling around the market-based sourcing and the highly digitized components of HB 280. You might recall a testimony from our Chief Economist, Dan Stickle, where he suggests that there's a range, market-based sourcing probably is about a $15 million net revenue impact, and then the highly digitized component has roughly about another $50 million. But again, that's a range. And so there's maybe, think of it maybe as one-third, two-thirds, as far as one-third attributed to market-based sourcing and then two-thirds of the potential revenue attributed to highly digitized business.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, the chair to our wonderful corporate tax folks. I wasn't kind of, let me rephrase that. I wasn't trying to reference the tax revenue modeling. I was trying to think of like the mechanic itself is kind of wonky, right? Because how I define what a digitized business is as percentage of their overall sales and categories. So what I'm saying, like if I'm a business and I do a lot of online business in Alaska, I'm going to kind of look at that and say, oh, well, actually, if I change my gross receipts a little bit, or if I have more personnel and property, I could actually not have a single sales factor. I could shift to basically the three factor, still under market-based sourcing, and lower my liability that way. Does that make sense through the chair?
Mr. Williams?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Staff. Yes, that's a fair presentation that there are opportunities for tax planning in the existing tax code, and there are opportunities for tax planning in the proposed tax code. And so those scenarios are certainly plausible.
One more follow-up.
Representative Staff?
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster through the chair. Obviously with your experience in corporate taxes, do most states try to streamline this as easy as possible? Because when I looked at this, most states that went to market-based sourcing, they went to single sales factor. Some used to do double-weighted sales factor, but they try to, from what my knowledge is they try to make it as consistent as possible for everyone, and I'm curious with your expertise in that area if that is what you've seen too through the chair.
Mr. Williams?
Through the chair, again, Michael Williams, Representative Staff. The 36 states that have adopted market-based sourcing, most of them, not all of them, but a lot of them have gone to single factor sales, again, recognizing that lower 48 dynamics and geography lend to market-based sourcing being the sole factor more so than Alaska. Alaska being more remote, we're not really a market state in the broader scheme of a corporate's overall structure. But that said, there are certainly opportunities there to revisit how it's structured.
And a final follow-up, Ms. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster, the chair. This one will be super simple. Unlike I feel like I'm a little inarticulate today because I'm a little under the weather, but how many states do something like this where they have a digitized factor and this traditional factor for pretty much all business? Is that like is that a normal thing to see, or like an abnormal thing to see through the chair?
Mr. Williams?
Yep, through the chair to represent staff. Our research, that we are unable to determine that there's any other state that has this highly digitized component. There are 36 states that use market-based sourcing, and certainly the sourcing rules for under market-based would encompass any business that is delivering goods and services electronically or by transmission of some other means. But nobody that we've not been able to identify another state that uses this highly digitized definition.
Thanks.
Okay, do we have any further questions, Representative Hennen?
Thank you, Chair Foster, and I'm not sure if it's Mr. Anderson or Mr. Williams that will answer my question. So I guess I'm a little thrown off by the answers to Representative Stapp because I thought we were joining a multi-state compact, but now I'm hearing that we have control of the definition that we use within the compact. So do we have total control, or we only have a binary decision to make?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I'll start the answer, and then Mr. Williams can provide some clarity. The multi-state compact portion of this bill only applies to the first portion of the market-based sourcing. So that is what we're changing. That is the multi-state compact portions that we're changing in the bill, and it's also what the governor does. The definition of highly digitized businesses is outside of the multi-state compact and added as a separate tax. The single sales factor is our own state corporate income tax portion, so it's not a component of the multi-state compact.
And that goes back to slide 5, if you could bring that back up. Representative Hannon, do you have any other further follow-ups?
One follow-up with Mr. Williams.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So, Mr. Williams, when you say so, 36 other states don't use a highly digitized definition, but could, in your analysis, have you found any other states that do such, that so much of their economy is digitized sales as opposed to I could shop at, and I'm going to just, you know, I could go to Target in person or I could buy at Target online, neither of which I could do here. Well, I guess I could do Target online here in Juneau. So is that the difference in your analysis, that in most locations you've got consumers and therefore potential tax revenue being determined on I've got an option of a brick and mortar or I've got an option for that same business digitally? But for many in Alaska, the only option is the digital version. There is no brick-and-mortar version of that commerce available.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, through the chair, to Representative Hannon. You're correct in that the way the other states deal with the digital goods and services is they just, when they've adopted market-based sourcing, they define delivery of digital goods and services, but they don't use the unique definition of highly digitized business component. That is not part of the model statute or regulations that the Multi-State Tax Commission had put forward to the states to adopt as part of their modernizing the Multi-State Compact.
Do we have any further questions? Representative Tomaszewski?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So I'm glad we're having a more of a discussion on this piece of legislation than we did when we had SB 113 come through. I think that one was kind of highly rushed at the end of session. But so I have a question. All this is making me think. So we have an Amazon warehouse distribution center in Fairbanks, Alaska. They have a fleet of blue vans and drivers. They have crews of package handlers and everyone that works in that warehouse. So they have property, they have personnel, they have sales. What is that? How is that going to affect, how is this legislation going to affect that particular business?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, I would have to get back to you on that specific. At this time, I don't have an answer. I don't know if DOR has addressed that in their analysis, but at this point, I would not have an answer for you.
Can I take brief at ease? Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:34 p.m. Just to put a finer point on that, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, and I'm going to go back to our wonderful corporate tax expert, Rep. Tomaszewski, actually asked a really, really good question. So my understanding, and I'll try to tick this as clearly as possible, my understanding is like the company mentioned they do have property, they do have payroll, and they do have sales. And that, to me, because of the nature of cost of performance, means they should already be subject to Alaska's corporate income tax, which you probably can't answer because of taxpayer confidentiality. So let me rephrase that to some company that sells primarily online that has property, payroll, and sales in Alaska, shouldn't they already be subject to Alaska's corporate income tax without these changes in the bill? Through the chair.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Stapp, and then I guess again, just to clarify, yes, we cannot speak to any specific company, but in your theoretical or hypothetical, the entity that already has a distribution warehouse and a fleet of trucks and payroll, they are already subject to Alaska's corporate income tax. And if they have delivery of services that are highly digitized, then if this were adopted with the highly digitized component, then we'd have to perform some type of analysis as to whether they cross that threshold of being subject under a single sales versus the three-factor formula.
Yeah, and follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up?
Yeah, just to kind of close out the point, it kind of goes back to having two makes it wonky, right? Because let's say a company that has, you know, the things we've mentioned, property, payroll, and sales, does a lot of digital sales. Now we're just talking about how valuable the property and the payroll is in the state as opposed to how valuable the sales is. So mechanically, this is really challenging to kind of parse. So, I mean, in your opinion, like, what's the best way to simplify it? Would that just be pick a certain apportionment factor and keep it, or use different ones for different businesses? Through the chair.
Mr. Williams?
Through the chair, again, Mike Williams, corporate tax manager. Through the chair to represent staff, I'll speak from 30 years of experience as a tax administrator that the preference of a tax administrator is that whatever statute you have is easily administered.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Tomaszewski, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Yeah, I still want to know exactly how that affects that business, because I think that's an important aspect of this piece of legislation. I mean, we could be giving tax breaks on that particular company by passing this legislation. So we need all the information we can to make a fiscally responsible decision. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, I've written it down, and I will make sure that the committee has an answer here as we develop on this bill.
So the purpose of this meeting and this bill was just to kind of roll it out, introduce it, get it on the table, and then we'll start getting into questions. We still, of course, have, you know, public testimony, amendments, so forth. But so if you do have any questions, feel free to, even if it's after finance, you know, get with Mr. Anderson. But we have plenty of time to continue asking questions as well. Representative Tomaszewski and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair. So in the last bullet point on your last page, you said these reforms will have little or no effect on Alaskan consumers since most online businesses use universal pricing. So, I mean, did you get that data? How did you arrive to that data that it is going to have zero, so little to none? How do you define little? I guess that's my first question.
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, when creating PowerPoint presentations, there's always that subjective interpretation of how to write a statement that is emphatic, encouraging, but also. So the point that was trying to be was made last year with SB 113 and moving forward is the fact that many of these digital companies, corporations, their pricing is universal. So the shovel that is bought in Minneapolis, I will use the one that was used last year, the shovel bought online in Minneapolis is the same price as the price that you would pay from a digital company here in Alaska. Same with Netflix or a streaming opportunity, a streaming company that has a membership, you're paying for that membership at the same price. So the idea is that there is from other states doing this and things, there has not been that push to have shifts in cost to consumers. I don't have anything in front of me at this moment to explain further on that.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, follow up. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So, okay. So another subject, online sales. I get on my online app of whatever my choosing. I look at an item, and I get really attached to it. And I think, I want to buy this. And I go to hit the button, and it says, will not ship to Alaska. And we've all experienced that, I would imagine. So is this going to increase the number of items that will not ship to Alaska if we pass this?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, I certainly hope not. I do not have an answer for the committee at this time. If that is something that we would definitely want to go down, I can get back to the committee on that.
It seems like a reason. It seems like a, I mean, how do you know? I mean, that's a difficult thing, but if there is any, I mean, if this has happened in other states, it would be nice to know that, well, Alaska is unusual in the fact that, you know, Alaska, Hawaii, I think we probably both get the same will not ship here. But that it's just interesting to think about and would be unfortunate if that did include a greater number of items that will not be shipped to Alaska. Thanks.
Refugees, times 241. House Finance back on record. The time is 2:42 p.m. So, Representative Tomaszewski, anything further on that? No. Okay. So, in the lineup, I've got Representative Hannon, Shragi, and Stapp. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chairman Foster. I guess I want to just express that my goal and interest in this bill, as we've talked about before, is to make sure that we are capturing taxation on business happening in Alaska, and if the multi-factor property, personnel, and sales, we want to perhaps make sure we're not creating a loophole. So whether it's, you know, if 50% of the business is digitized and you've got to go to a higher threshold and go, it's all got to be digitized or 75%, but if you have property and payroll, you must use the multi-factor, that the digitized portion that we are adding into our new corporate structure is for digitized businesses without property and personnel. Because our goal behind this is to make sure that we're capturing the corporate income taxes that are already being paid by these corporations in other jurisdictions, and that we're not creating a loophole for any corporations that are currently paying tax in Alaska under our multi-factor sales. So I know that we're now speculating that it potentially, if I had the choice of a business, a small subset may have an option, but I think that we can craft a way that we don't give the corporation the option, that the law says either you're digitized and taxed there or you're property and personnel and you're taxed there, so that we aren't creating a loophole where someone could go, I sold more shovels this week, so I'm going digitize tax. Additionally, I think when I encounter a digital sale that doesn't deliver to Alaska, it's always about the delivery and shipping. It's the shippers who say, I don't ship off the continent, explaining that they failed geography because we are on the continent. And, you know, businesses who just say, it's too complicated. Our time frames don't work. We promised you a 48-hour delivery, and we can't hold up to that in Alaska because you guys have weird weather and great distances. So companies are designed to sell things, and they want to sell things that are complicated, and the idea of how do you get it to Alaska is overwhelming for some businesses, but that's not going to be changing based on their corporation tax, because their goal is to capture every sale for anybody that possibly is interested in their product if they can. Thank you.
Thank you. In the queue I've got, and I don't know, Mr. Anderson probably didn't have anything to say with regard to the last. I've got Representative Schrage, Stapp, and Allard. Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Really appreciate the discussion we're having today. I think it's a good discussion and one that's aided by our prior discussions on similar bills that have come before us before. Just listening to the discussion that we've had, a couple of things have come to mind that I wanted to just add to the discussion or provide some clarity on. You know, one thing, looking at the last slide on the presentation on some of the important benefits of HB 280, I think one of the ones that's really missing here that is important to the discussion is the fact that today, currently, there is a loophole in Alaska's corporate tax income tax structure. And that loophole is that if you're a highly digital business that doesn't have a physical presence here in the state, you are not paying taxes to the state of Alaska. You're paying those taxes to other states. And that's incredibly problematic because that means essentially these companies are having their profits subsidized. They're delivering. They've got a whole other market that's out there, the market that is Alaska, and they're able to use our infrastructure, our services to make those sales, make those transactions, deliver goods to Alaskans, make money off of us, and then not pay a corporate income tax, while those companies that choose to invest here in Alaska and have a physical presence are paying that corporate income tax. I think that's a major loophole, a major unfairness, and something that should be resolved. I do take Representative Tomaszewski's concerns seriously that some businesses, some corporate structured C-Corp businesses would potentially see a small tax reduction, and that is maybe problematic. I don't particularly like the idea of maybe reducing the corporate income taxes of Amazon, but I think we need to look at it more holistically, and you can do that when you look at the fiscal note. Even if we're giving a couple of companies, even large national companies like, well, Amazon, we've said it many times here, but any business of similar structure, even if we're giving them a small tax break, it pales in comparison to the revenue that we're collecting from all those corporate companies that are currently benefiting off that loophole. And that's shown by the positive fiscal note of $25 to $65 million in revenue. So maybe some small reductions to one-off companies, but we're capturing revenues from a whole bunch of others that are currently freeloading off of the state. I think that's incredibly concerning, and I think we need to not let perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, Representative Stapp talked about how potentially you could game the system. You're maybe near that threshold of being considered a highly digital company. I can tell you, as someone with an accounting degree married to a CPA, there is no perfect tax structure that is not gameable, that tax planning will not benefit a taxpayer by doing. You know, look at the seasonal sales tax bill that was before us. Many states use that structure, but we know that if you have a seasonal sales tax that ramps up in the summer, many folks are going to start buying their cars, you know, in March and April before that summer sales tax kicks in. And so any system that we put before us can be gamed, and I think we need to keep all of those trade-offs in the context of what do we gain as a state by reforming our corporate income tax structure. And again, I point people to that fiscal note that we have. Now, couple other concerns that have been brought up that I just wanted to really quickly touch on. One, making sure that prices aren't increasing to Alaskan consumers, because I haven't touched on that yet. And the other is on the making sure that the availability of those products and services is still there for Alaskans. We don't want to see all of a sudden more companies saying we're not shipping to Alaska. So on those two points, I think we've seen very clearly from the prior discussions that we've had on this bill and prior bills like it, more specifically on the prior bills just like it, no matter what your corporate income tax rate is across the country, when you go to buy that product on Amazon or you go to buy that subscription on Hulu or Netflix or whatever else it is, whatever other business or service it is, that price is the same. I'm not aware of a single company out there. There may be one. I'd be happy to be proven wrong. I hope you can show me more than just one company to have some oomph behind it. But I'm not aware of a single company that either chooses to ship or not ship or chooses to base their prices off of what the corporate income tax structure is in that state. And then finally, just on that shipping note, number one reason that a product is not shipped to Alaska, it's a hazardous good, and it's a pain in the butt to ship. I don't think that our corporate income tax structure is going to dramatically change the number of goods that are shipped to Alaska. So I do think there are some very legitimate concerns that have been brought up. We do need to look at how these companies are maybe going to use that tax planning to game the system. I think that's a very legitimate concern that we should look at. You know, we should make sure that the rates are right, the definitions are right. But I think some of the concerns that have been highlighted today, you know, they're real, but I think that they pale. They just don't meet the level of concern that I think would warrant us not moving forward on something like this that would, again, generate a significant amount of revenue from companies that are freeloading and being subsidized by the state of Alaska and by the residents of Alaska. So no question there. I hope this has been a positive contribution to the discussion, but I know that I have constituents that watch this that have some of these similar concerns, and I wanted to make sure I got my perspective on the record. So thank you to the chair for the indulgence.
Thank you. Next up, I've got Representative Stapp and then Allard. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So I have a few here because there's a couple things my friend Rep. Schrage said that I think can actually be explained fairly well. So my first question would be to Mr. Anderson. Actually, let me do the loophole thing first, actually. Through the chair to our wonderful corporate tax folks. Can you articulate the difference between the change to market-based sourcing, which effectively captures that, and the change to the apportionment? I feel like some folks are getting the fact that we're using a different apportionment model for a digitized business in this bill, as opposed to not really grasping that market-based sourcing alone basically solves the people aren't paying money issue through the chair.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, through the chair, again, Mike Williams, Corporate Tax Manager, Department of Revenue, through the chair to Representative Stapp. Trying to maybe rephrase your question.
Yeah, I'll simplify it if I can.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster through the chair. If you're if you sell into Alaska your digital business and we use market-based sourcing, we are capturing that no matter what apportionment factor we use, three-factor or single-factor. Correct, through the chair.
Mr. Williams.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, that would be correct. Market-based sourcing would capture those digital sales of goods and services, whereas the current formula does not.
So, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Through the chair to Mr. Anderson, and if you can't answer, we can just defer to the corporate tax guy. Throw back and throw out rules. So when you talk about companies paying taxes, throw back and throw out rules. They're not included in the slide deck, but do you know what I'm referencing when I say that, Mr. Anderson? Do you want to defer?
Through the chair, I'd defer.
Okay. Through the chair to our wonderful corporate tax folks. Can you articulate how throw back and throw out rules kind of work regarding apportionment through the chair?
Mr. Williams?
Yeah, again, through the chair to Representative Stapp. Throwback sales and throughout sales. I'll start with throwback. So the concept of throwback is that if I make a sale into a location where I do not have nexus, meaning I don't have physical presence, then instead of that sale being assigned to where it was delivered, it goes back to where it came from. So if you think of an online streaming service based out of California, streaming all over the country, but to customers in Alaska, they don't have physical presence here, so they don't assign sales to their customers in Alaska, but instead those sales go back to the place of origin, which is some network server out of California or whatever state it's located in. Throwout rule means that if there are certain types of what we want to call intangibles, that they're so amorphous that they're really used everywhere and you can't really cite it to any one particular location where it's used, then it's that type of sale is thrown out altogether from being represented in the factor.
And just quick follow-up on that, Mr. Kocher.
Representative Sale.
Yeah, thank you, Kocher Foster, through chair. Yeah, reason I want that just explained on the record is because it'll simplify this question really quickly. So they're paying corporate taxes. They're just not paying it to us when they sell stuff through the chair, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Staff, yes, that would generally be correct, they're paying corporate tax somewhere else other than Alaska.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, next question, Representative Allard.
Thanks. It's more of like more of a comment. I think that, thank you, Chair, that we've been sitting here saying that this particular HB 280 is not necessarily going to impact the consumer. That's just not accurate. If you look at, it was a quick Google. Anybody can look at it. 10% price hikes will go with cable and streaming. So you've got Netflix, you've got Hulu, you've got other. They said if you do this, as it does in other states, there's going to be a 10% increase for the consumer because it's all passed down. They said direct cost pass-through, so they target digital taxes. And so in Washington and Maryland, they raised the taxes, or they did one of the, an HB 280, and the consumers were then taxed even greater. So the products do go and increase in fees. It's just the way it is. I mean, if you're going to compare us to Mississippi, then Mississippi says that they've increased drastically the prices of their goods based on the tax. So that's an interesting thing. And then they said when you buy technology products like monitors, computers, iPhones, it goes up to 31 to 32%. So somehow that will get to the consumer, and Alaskan's going to pay for it. And unfortunately, my dog food that comes from Amazon is probably going to go up too. I also have a question a little bit more with Representative Shragi, if I may. You're always saying loophole, loophole, loophole in the law. So are you saying that the law that was presented in order for goods to come and individuals with C Corp or whatever pay less, are you saying that those were unintended consequences with the law, or do you think that when the law was there, it was actually intended? Sure, if you don't mind, is that okay, Chair? Mm-hmm. I didn't want to put Representative Shragi on the spot, but I'm pretty sure he's confident enough to answer the question.
Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. First, a request back at you, if I may. Whatever documents you're referencing there on those costs being passed on, I'd love to see that. Would love to see some evidence of that. Because in my review, we've not seen those costs being passed on to consumers. Yes, I do believe it's a loophole. When these corporate income taxes were first passed, you go back and look at the history of it, there were no highly digitized businesses.
Okay.
Our tax structure was designed to capture income from every C corporation, and of course we have a carve-out for our oil and gas industry, but our corporate income taxes were envisioned to collect a corporate income tax from our C corporation businesses, and at the time there simply were no, there was no internet, there were no internet-based companies, there were no digital sales across state lines, and so as a result, because we have not updated our corporate income tax structure in Alaska, these new types of businesses that do not fall under that apportionment structure that I don't have the slide in front of me now, but I'm sure Mr. Anderson could switch to it, they're not captured under that. And so they just pay no corporate income tax, while many other C corporations do pay that corporate income tax. And I would view that very clearly as a loophole. And frankly, an unfair tax environment for our various companies that may want to do business here in Alaska. Does that answer your question adequately, Representative Allard?
Yes, and May I respond real quick? So in regards to the source I use, you can just Google it anywhere. I didn't have a piece of paper or document. You can look under the Washington and the Mississippi laws and Maryland in regards to the tax increases. It is naive to say that this law will not pass on to the consumer. It absolutely will increase the product prices, especially out in rural communities. And honestly, Alaska's rural. So any products I get, they might say, oh, the cost is different down in the lower 48 or here, or it's the same. It's just not true. My dog food's more expensive there.
Sorry. Chair Foster.
Thanks.
If I may. Just
Representative Allard, you just want to make sure you're done. Representative Allard.
Were you done?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Oh,
okay. Representative Froggy.
Thank you, Chair Foster, for the indulgence on a little bit of the back and forth. Even if it's easily Googleable, I would still appreciate just one of those Google results.
No,
because there's different types of taxes, and yes. I'm not arguing that if we were to, I mean, there are many options before us, and there are some tax proposals that we could pursue that I believe would very clearly be passed on to the consumer. I have not seen any evidence that this type of corporate income tax would have any impact, or that there is any evidence of it ever having been done in the past in a way in which those costs were passed on to consumers. So if there's even just one of those searches that you feel is good evidence, if I could see that, I would appreciate being able to understand what kind of tax is being
referenced. I'll get my staff to do that, Chair, but just one last thing.
Representative
Schrage, do you believe that the individuals that have the C-Corp that are going to be taxed on this, even in the state of Alaska, do you believe that they're not going to pass that on to the consumers?
Representative Schrage?
Chair Foster, I think many of the C-corporations that would potentially be taxed under this structure are in many cases companies that have revenues in the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, and that the 25 to 65 million that would be brought in aggregate across all companies that are taxed under this proposal would be a rounding error for them, and they would not go through the time and expense because it is very expensive and it takes a lot of time to have your corporate tax lawyers go through and revise things. I don't think that they would adjust all of the assets that would be required to adjust prices simply because we had a very small tax that we imposed that would ultimately be a rounding error for them on their balance sheets.
And not for small businesses either. You don't think it's going to impact the small businesses either?
Representative Allard, that was Representative Allard. Representative Schrage?
Chair Foster, I think we need to get, I don't have good insight into the small businesses that would be captured under the structure, and we can have further discussion on that, I'm sure.
It'll impact them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair for Mr. Williams. You've heard this dialogue between members of the Finance Committee. My understanding is that the total sum paid by a digitalized operating company would be restrained by water's edge, and so the impulse to increase prices for a 38th state, which Alaska would be, simply isn't there because we're not growing their total corporate income tax. We're redistributing part to Alaska. Is that right?
Mr. Williams?
Again, for the record, Mike Williams, corporate tax manager, through the chair to Representative Josephson. That point of view is how the department has looked at it, that this is really shifting taxes paid to other states, corporate income taxes paid to other states, to Alaska, where recognizing where the digital goods and services are being delivered.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So in my district in South Midtown Anchorage, there is a new warehouse with a national company that does national digitalized sales and other distribution. In this discussion about whether we would be better off with a three-factor test or a market-based test, I guess what I'm wondering is, wouldn't you have to consider all of the company's e-book sales, sales that are flown here that are not coming out of an Alaska warehouse, and I think there's still a lot of those. For example, if you're ordering something in Juneau, there's no warehouse here. My guess is those are still airborne. Those are still flown here. So even though these companies have some physical presence, apparently in Anchorage and Fairbanks, for instance, I just think, now this is me playing a hunch, but that the value of those sales would be overwhelmed, just overwhelmed by the value of ebook sales through systems like Kindle or Audible, through streaming movies, television, and then other sales coming from warehouses in the lower 48. Am I right about that? That hunch?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I quite honestly, I can't put a finger on any analysis that would give me an idea that would require some additional work on our part. And I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to really quickly return to the dialogue with Representative Allard from a moment ago, because I had a friend reach out and remind me why I just have an accounting degree and I'm not a CPA. On the question as to whether or not there's small businesses that would be caught up under this tax structure, I'm reminded that almost no small businesses are structured as a C corporation. It's not an advantage tax structure for a business, and so you would see very, very, very few businesses that are small businesses that are C corporations. And if you want more information on kind of how businesses go about making that decision as to how to structure themselves and the incentives they're for or against, I'd be happy to get you some more information on that. But I believe the impact of small businesses would be very few and far between.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. I think it's more that when you're dealing with small businesses, they do deal with the large corporations and the C corporations, and they do buy bulk products, and they do business with the larger companies. So the small businesses, the S corps, are going to be impacted. We could disagree on that. That's okay. And tell your friend thank you. I already knew that, though, but thanks. I got one from Sarah, Representative Hannon, too.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I've appreciated all of this conversation. Sounds like there are some more questions to be answered, but the one that I have in mind especially, which I think that I heard an answer to the last time I went through this bill, but now I'm starting to question it, and that is around displaced taxes. So in other words, it felt like before what we were doing especially was capturing taxes that were ordinarily paid in other states where the corporation was fundamentally located in other locations, fundamentally. But now, and so they were paying taxes in those states, and we were saying, wait a minute, if the item is being purchased and ending up in Alaska, and they're using our roads and all the other systems and our broadband and everything else in order to make that business happen, that we should capture those taxes right here. And I guess the only thing I'd like to know is, where did I go wrong there? Is that not true? If you have that answer, I'd like to hear it. Otherwise, I think we're complicating it maybe more than it should be.
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, Representative, you are correct. That was the conversation that Mr. Williams had with Representative Stapp on the difference between a throwback and a throwout and that nexus. If Mr. Williams would want to clarify a little bit more concisely with how it relates to your question, I would defer to him.
Representative Galvin.
So, Co-Chair Foster, Mr. Williams, I would appreciate hearing if there are nuances to what I described. I'm guessing that there are. And I also heard you mention something about, or rather, I think it was Mr. Brody mentioned something about more than 50% online. And so, you know, perhaps that's where I'm a bit confused. I just want to make sure that there's not something new to this that has jumped out since the last time I heard this.
Mr. Williams?
I guess through the chair to represent Galvin, the overall concept of where we've talked about corporate tax currently being paid in other states due to the fact that these companies are delivering goods and services digitally to Alaska but do not otherwise have a physical presence here. Mm-hmm. So the concept of that your understanding is correct in that we're essentially shifting taxes paid to other states, those 36 other states that use a market-based sourcing rule, then some of the revenue paid to those states is coming back to Alaska to recognize that under a market-based sourcing rule, goods and digital goods and services are being delivered here to our current statute does not capture, because our current statute is a cost of performance model that does not recognize the digital economy to the extent that it possibly could.
Thank you.
And I forgive me if there's a second half to that question that I've missed.
Representative Galvin.
Through Co-Chair Foster, the second half was around the more than 50%. So I guess there's some question about some larger companies that might have a tiny footprint here, but their mainframe footprint is in some other state, and most of their business here, more than 50%, is online. So that's, I guess, what I was trying to get clarity around.
Mr. Williams?
Right, and that, through the chair again to Representative Galvin, that is the part where, again, we haven't presented specific analysis on any particular industry or companies, but that generally speaking, the highly digitized component could shift the nature of what is being taxed or how a corporation is being taxed. If they otherwise had a footprint here, they would normally fall under the three-factor formula: property, payroll, and sales. But with this new definition of highly digitized business, that could shift to the single sales factor of just because more than 50% of their sales occurs electronically.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. As far as the fiscal note, have you changed that? Are we still at what the slide says, which is 25 to 60 million? Has that changed?
Mr. Williams.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin, no, that has not changed.
Okay, that's all I need. Thank you so much.
Okay, I don't see any further questions, so I thank you very much, Mr. Williams, Mr. Anderson, for presenting the bill, answering questions. Did I hear Mr. Anderson? Go ahead.
I do have one last portion of the presentation, not on the slide deck, but I believe it's important to point out to the committee, if I could turn the attention to the sectional analysis. I won't go through the entire sectional, but I will give a very high overview of the sectional, but there is a section that is important to point out. If you have the sectional in front of you, it's a two-page sectional. Just to be clear, sections 1 through 6 deal with the multi-state compact changes, that is changing it from the over to the market-based sourcing. Section 7 is the section of the highly digitized definition and that change to a single sales apportionment factor. But then most importantly, sections 8 and 9 deal with the transition of the tax, and this bill does include in Section 9 a retroactive clause of January 1, 2026. So if this bill in its current form passes, there is a retroactive clause that would create the tax post or pre-passage of the bill. I think that's important for the committee members to know.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Mr. Anderson. Yeah, thanks for the reminder. I knew that retroactivity portion. I just kind of forgot in this lengthy discussion. But I know that the court says it's legal to go back and make people, we can pass bills that have retroactive changes. But, I mean, how, you know, you've been around the building a long time. How often has that been a thing that we've done, changed taxes and made it retroactive? Through the chair.
Through the chair, I would have to definitely go back and take a look. I know the number is small. But one of the commitments that this bill was, the idea of having that clause in there was because of the previous version of the bill that was passed and vetoed, had that tax begin at 126. So instead of trying to argue why we then pushed it forward. The decision was made to just establish that same date with a retroactive clause. But you are correct that it is more rare than normal to have a retroactive tax clause.
My fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you. So just out of curiosity, as we've heard today, if this bill passed, I guess, right now in its current form, there's quite a bit of complexity. Have you checked with, say, revenue regarding how long they would need to have a regulatory package draft for this bill through the chair?
Mr. Anderson.
Excuse me, I'm just looking at my notes for... At this point, through the chair, I don't have an answer on that. I will make that conversation more in depth with the department.
And then just quick comment, Mr. Co-Chair.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just clarifying the record. The reason I asked the question is obviously the bill's complicated. If we're going to have a retroactive effective date, you know, obviously the department has to define what all these words we just talked about all day means, and that probably takes time. So in theory, you could actually have a retroactive tax that is supposed to be changed, or how you're supposed to pay your income tax or corporate income tax changed, and the companies not know how they're supposed to do that, like months down the road, yet they already owe the taxes. So I just, from a fundamental principle, I think it's probably not a wise idea that we would want to do that through the chair. Thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Williams, are most of the corporations that you are dealing with for C-Corps paying taxes to us on a calendar year that begins on January 1st of every year and concludes on December 31st, or are they fragmented to less than that?
Mr. Williams.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, again, Mike Williams, Alaska Corporate Tax Manager. You are correct that the majority of corporations that file with us are calendar year corporations.
Follow-up.
And thank you, through the chair. Mr. Williams, is it your sense that if tax codes change in the middle of the year, most C-Corps have accounting offices that are going to study changes in tax code and be able to prepare them because they're always doing a look back? You're paying your 26 taxes in 27, but you've got that whole year of collection and your CPA is ready to make sure that you've taken advantage of all the ways that the tax code could or does not apply to you.
Mr. Williams.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe your statement is a fair assumption. In my experience as an administrator, I deal with large corporations and they all have professional firms that help them with their taxes, in addition to large in-house staff.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Mr. Anderson, my question is in regards to regs. I heard previously from different members about how important it was that we had regs prepared before we passed a bill. Is that the normal procedure?
Mr. Williams?
I was asking Mr. Anderson, but if Mr. Williams is familiar with this, that would be helpful. I just want to make sure that we all are aware of what the pattern of how we make these decisions should roll in terms of implementation.
Let's stick with Mr. Williams first, and then we'll come to Mr. Anderson. Mr. Williams?
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair to Representative Galvin. I can't specifically speak to what a regulation package would look like under this bill, but I can say that the Multi-State Tax Commission has proposed model regulations that are meant to accompany adoption of model statutes that go to market-based sourcing. So there is already a framework of regulations that the Multi-State Tax Commission has adopted and proposed that states use when going to market-based sourcing.
Thank you. That's very helpful to know and somewhat unusual, I'm guessing. But Mr. Anderson, if you could also fill in the gaps. And typically when we when we pass bills, are regulations done before or after the bill passes?
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, I will Representative, it is my understanding that the standard procedure is the passage of a bill. It is forwarded then to the department to then create the regulations. There's usually a drafting period, and then if it's open to the public, there can be a public review of that regs, and then they step into that process. It can be anywhere from 90 days plus. But that is just a very high anecdotal assumption, not backed, not readily available with sight and verse.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I also appreciate hearing from Mr. Williams that there may be a head start to some degree on this work ahead, should it come to pass. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So just to clarify comments I made that were kind of referenced there, I didn't say that you needed the regulatory framework created before you passed a bill. I said you should have the regulatory framework in place after the bill passes so you can pay the taxes timely, right? Especially companies filing quarterly taxes. So that's a reference from when we passed, when a Senate bill version of this bill passed, it had a delayed effective date in the passage. And it had a delayed effective date because the DOR or revenue folks said on the record, because of the things that we've talked about today, that they needed time to create a reg package so they could roll this thing out effectively on time. So just to clarify the record, right now what we're talking about with this bill is it has a retroactive effective date, so it hasn't passed. So if it were to pass, companies would be in the middle of the year operating under this tax structure. Representative Hannon mentioned, and the answer of the question, just because they can do that, my argument is going to be just because we can do that and companies might be able to absorb that, it's probably better if we didn't make them go back and change their structure in middle year. That's all. Thank you.
Foster. Representative Schrage.
I think the question here is better for who, but I take his point seriously. I think it is a legitimate one, just trying to make a little light of it here. Thank you, Chair Foster.
Okay, I don't see any further questions. So with that, thank you, everyone. Our next scheduled meeting is Monday, February 16 at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we'll hear House Bill 289. That's the supplemental bill. Then we'll also receive a overview from Judiciary on their budgets in both the operating and capital. And then from there, that's it. So with that, we'll be adjourned at 3:21 p.m. Thank you.